Okay, this is the Yecheskel Shir. The Ilu Nishmos Mefraim Ephraim Shmuel ben Avram Aryeh HaKohen and Chaya Tova Bas Eliezer Mendel HaKohen on the Book of Yecheskel. It's also dedicated to all our soldiers, as ever. We're holding in Yecheskel chapter 16 and verse 7. This is a allegory. It's a description based on an allegory of a foundling child, a foundling baby girl. Which the allegory, the parable, is to God, so to speak, discovering the Jewish people and taking them under his wing. We're up to the point, we dealt with the idea of the Bris Mila last week and the circumcision. And now we're up to verse 7, which is also a verse that we find in the Haggadah. Like the previous verse. The previous verse is also found in the Haggadah, which we say on first night of Pesach or on Seder night. This verse is also there straight after it. And God now, or the prophet now, describes the Jewish people as she starts to grow up, as the foundling child baby begins to grow up in towards adulthood. So he says, Revova kitzemach hasoda nesatich. I let you thrive, God says. I let you thrive like a blossom in the field. Vatirbi, vatigdali, and you grew, and you reached adulthood. Vatovoi, ba'adi adoyim, and you became perfectly beautiful. Shodaim nochonu, with fashioned firm breasts. Usa'orech tzimeach, and your pubic hair grew. Va'at erom ve'eriyeh. But you were still naked and bare. You were still unclothed. So what's he talking about here? So let's start at the top. This is a very, very deep verse describing the nature of the Jewish people as they started to grow up, as they started to become from a child into an adult, into a nation. Revova kitzemach hasoda nesatich vatirbi vatigdali, says the prophet. God says, I let you thrive like a blossom in the field, and you grew and reached adulthood. This means that God arranged for the foundling baby girl, the Israelites, despite their oppressive conditions of slavery, to flourish while they were in Egypt. We see this in the Torah, despite the fact that they were under tremendous pressure of work and slavery. The first chapter in Shemos tells us, "Uvnei Yisrael poru vayishritzu vayirbu vayatzmu b'maod maod, v'timolei ha'aretz osam." The Israelites were fertile and prolific; they multiplied greatly. If you do the maths and try and work out the time frame, so it works out that on average they had six children per family, despite the fact that they were under tremendous pressure. And it says, "Vatimoleho aretzosom," until the land of Egypt was full of them, which was one of the reasons why the Egyptians started to get a bit frantic about a fifth column inside their own country. But exactly how were the Israelites multiplying at such a fantastic rate when the Egyptians were still busy throwing their children into the Nile and plastering them into the pyramids, which the Jews were actually building? So the Gemara in Sota. Explains it like this. When the Egyptians recognized Jewish babies, they would come and kill them. And the Gemara then goes into some type of Kabbalistic turn, and it says that a miracle would happen to these children, and these babies that were killed and buried would be absorbed into the earth. And the Egyptians would then bring the oxen and plow the land. After the Egyptians left, these babies would emerge miraculously. They'd grow out of the ground like grass growing out of the field. And that's what Yechezkel is saying here. Revova kitzemach hasode nesatich vatirbi vatigdali. I let you thrive and you regrew like blossoms in the field, and you were nurtured and reached adulthood. All the babies that were killed in Egypt, they were reborn. They were resurrected. And once the babies grew into adulthood, in fact, they were reborn as adults, the Gemara says, and they would return like flocks of sheep to their homes. as Yechezkel says here, and he became perfectly beautiful. Says the Gemara, don't read it ba'adi adoyim, perfectly beautiful. Rather read it be'edre adorim, like a multitude of returning flocks. So the Gemara there is making out that although it appears from the simple reading of the Torah that hundreds of thousands, maybe a million Jewish children were murdered by the Egyptians, there was no losses there. All the children that were killed by the Egyptians were resurrected, and that's what Yechezkel is getting at here. Ravova ketzema chatzoda, that you thrived, you grew out of the ground. It's interesting that this idea of children growing out of the ground, like if you saw it, you'd be, if you, for example, if you went to the Rav Dessler brings this example, that when you walk past a tree during the daytime, so you don't pay any attention to it at all. It's natural. Just the trees are everywhere, right? Grass, trees, shrubberies, plants, flowers. You pay no attention to any of them. But let's say you're in a cemetery and you're visiting a loved one on the yacht site, or you went to the cemetery for a stone setting or whatever it was. And then all of a sudden next to you, a human being started growing out of the ground and with roots. Coming out of the ground with roots, if you looked at it and saw it, you'd run for your life. And Rav Dessler says, why would you do that? After all, you've seen apple trees growing out of the ground. You see your roses in the garden growing out of the ground. Why is it so shocking to believe that human beings can grow out of the ground? And he says, the only reason why you found it shocking is because you don't see it. But it's no less a miracle, it's no greater miracle than the miracle of nature, that we call nature. The fact that grass grows, that trees grow, that roses grow, and this is the idea of the Gemara here. The idea of the Gemara here, it's that the children didn't die. The children were resurrected. They grew out of the ground like grass. Alternatively, that's the way the Gemara understands it. Alternatively, we can understand the phrase "Vatavoi ba'adi adoyim," you became perfectly beautiful. Literally, meaning the foundling baby girl or the Israelites that God found reached a stage where they were showing signs of some type of maturity and were at a point where they could go out into the world. In other words, it was time for the Israelites to be redeemed. The time for redemption had arrived. And the Jewish people, as we'll see, what were the signs of their maturity? So we'll see shortly. But what were the signs of adulthood? So God continues. He says, "Shodaim nochonu usorech tzimeach." This is beautiful poetry. You had two beautifully fashioned, firm breasts, and your pubic hair began to grow. So that's the allegory to the foundling child that's being brought up by the gentle chap that finds this child alone in the field. But the analogy here means the foundling baby and the foundling baby girl, the Israelites, showed signs of puberty. What does that mean? So the Medrash tells you what it means. So the Medrash says, "Vayar Elohim es bnei Yisrael vayeda Elohim." God saw the children. This is a pasuk from Shemos. It says, "God saw the children of Israel and knew." Vayar Elohim es bnei Yisrael vayeda Elohim, and God knew. And the Medrash says, "What did God see that He knew something? He knew. He found something new." So the Medrash says that the pasuk here says, "Shodaim nochonu usorech tzimeach." God saw that the Israelites, they developed breasts and their pubic hair had grown, and that the Israelites were showing signs of puberty, maturity. They were ready to be redeemed. And the Medrash asks, if that's true, then it should have said first, usorech tzimeach, your pubic hair grew, and only then shodaim nochonu, that their breasts developed. As the Medrash says, the lower signs of puberty precedes the upper ones. So the Medrash says, rather, what does the verse mean when it says shodaim nochonu, their breasts, nochonu, had developed? Now the word, it's a play on the word nochonu, which in this context means developed. The Medrash says, Shodayim, the two breasts mentioned in this verse, refer to Moshe and Aaron, who were Nechonim, not Nechonu, Nechonim. As the verse says, these two leaders, Moshe and Aaron, Nechonu, were prepared by God to redeem the Israelites. That's what it means. Shodayim Nechonu. Not that they're literally, in the context of the allegory, it would mean that the child's breasts had developed. In the context of the allegory, as it relates to the children of Israel that were in Egypt, it means that God prepared Shodayim. He prepared two leaders. Nechonu means to prepare, Nechonim. And God prepared two leaders to redeem them. And so the analogy of the two breasts referred to Moshe and Aaron. And it's clear that that's what it's referring to, because Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, writing in Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, when he refers to the Jewish people as having been given Shnei Shodayich Kishnei Aforim, two breasts like two fawns. And Rashi said, tells us there, Shnei Shodayich Hameinikos Osoch Zemoshe V'Aaron, that the two breasts of the Jewish people that showed them, that gave them the signs of maturity and puberty, was the leadership of Moshe and Aaron. They were the one that Meinikos, they, I don't know the word, how to translate it into English, but to what a mother does, she breastfeeds the children. But they were the ones. They were the ones that created some type of maturity and within the Jewish people. And then, says the Medrash, only then does God mention in Yechezkel, U'se'irech tzomeach, that and then your pubic hair grew. Meaning, only now that you had two breasts, Moshe and Aaron, two leaders who were prepared to lead you out of Egypt, could the people reach a state of full maturity? That there's usarech tzimeach, that their pubic hair grew. A fact that signaled the time of redemption has arrived, just as the arrival of pubic hair serves as a sign of the culmination of childhood and the start of adulthood. So that is the way the Medrash reads this pasuk. Very flowery and very poetic. But there's still a problem here, as is pointed out by the Malbim, because it says at the end of the verse, Va'at Eirom Ve'Eriyeh, you were still naked, you were still bare, you were still enclosed. And this is the problem, says the Malbim. Rak Shehem Hoyu Odin Arumim, Shelo Hoyu Beyodam Toro Mitzvah Zuchoyos. Shehem habagodim hem elitzim bidei hanefesh. When the verse says, when Yechezkel says here, they were reaching a state of maturity. They had leaders who were prepared to lead them and show them the way. Nevertheless, it says, va'at eirom ve'eriyeh, they were still naked. What were they naked of? And says the Malbim, odin arum shlo hoya b'yam Torah mitzvahs. They had nothing to recommend them. They were still naked. They were lacking in Torah. They hadn't received the Torah yet. They weren't doing any mitzvahs. They had no merits, which are the real clothing of a human being. That's the clothing of the soul. That's what it means, va'at eirom ve'eriyeh. Not that they were physically naked, but they were spiritually naked. They hadn't received the Torah. They weren't doing any mitzvahs in Egypt. And they had accumulated no merits in Egypt during that period. So God says, yeah, you were reaching a state of maturity. I'd given you two leaders, but things weren't working out because you were still naked. You still hadn't responded. We'd reached a point where I was prepared to redeem you, but you still had nothing really to recommend you for me to say, right, let's go. So that is the Malbim. That's what he says. That's the problem. That's the problem with the redemption. The problem with the redemption is, although they'd reached a stage of maturity with leaders, they still hadn't merited. They still didn't merit redemption. But what's interesting about this language here at the end of the verse is that God describes them in a double expression. But at a Rome, the area. Like, why? You could have said, va'at eirom, you were naked. It doesn't say that. It says, va'at eirom ve'eriyeh, you were naked and bare, naked and naked, unclothed twice. Why are the Israelites' nakedness of Torah, mitzvahs, and merits described with a double expression, Eirom ve'Ariyeh? So this is something that's troubled all the commentators, and this expression. And again, we say this, you know, people who go, you know, Seder night every year, and this is one of the verses in the Haggadah that we just brush past because no one seems to know what it means. But now that we've actually gone through it, so maybe this Seder night you'll have something to say about this verse. But exactly why it's expressed that the Jewish people were naked and bare, and you have to have a double expression. So again, there's 20 explanations for this, but I'm going to give you four, the four that appealed to me. There are others, people can go searching for them. The first one is the Malbim. The Malbim says, Eirom ve'Ariyeh, Ariyeh hu golui beiso erevel. That the word Eirom describes somebody partially clothed, with their private parts covered, which would mean that the Israelites had some Torah and had some mitzvahs in their favor. The word ve'Ariyeh, the second expression, however, describes someone totally naked, exposing their sexual organs. Shehu yose me'erom, sheyovo gam alma mochusa katsas, indicating that in the one sense they were partially clothed, in another sense they were totally naked, which indicates, he says, that the foundling girl, this foundling baby girl, the Israelites, that were now approaching maturity, they should have had merits at this time because they had leaders, they had Moshe, they had Aaron, and they had Miriam as well. But despite that, Aaron, you'd have expected them to be partially clothed, which is what the word Aaron means, but in fact they weren't. They were Ariyeh. They were totally naked, and they had no merits warranting them worthy of redemption. So that's the Malbim says that's what it means, Eirom ve'Ariyeh. You might have thought that they should have had some Eirom, they might have been partially clothed, something to recommend them. Says God, no, the Ariyeh. You were completely devoid of anything to promote the idea that you were worthy of redemption. The Barbanel and others say that the word Eirom is masculine, and the word Ariyeh is feminine, indicating that neither the enslaved Jewish men or the women had any merits to warrant redemption. So the word Eirom ve'Ariyeh is just describing, you might have thought that the men had some merits. So it says, no, Eirom, the men had nothing, they were naked. You might have thought the women had some merits, so it says, no, Ariyeh in the feminine, to tell you nobody. There was nothing to recommend them for redemption. So that's the second way of understanding it. Yeah, we've got the opinion of the Radak here, which is, again, he says the double expression Eirom ve'Ariyeh may refer to the fact that whilst in Egypt, not only were Jews bereft of any Torah, mitzvahs, or good deeds, or zechuyot, merits, that would count in their favor, but that many as 80%, were actively pagans. As Yecheskel will inform us later, when we get to chapter 20 in verse 8, Yecheskel will actually tell us that. It says, Vayamru vi, this is a chapter later on, chapter 20, verse 8, Vayamru vi, they rebelled against me, lo ovo lishmoelai, and they wouldn't listen to me. Ish eshkutze enehem lo hishlichu, none of them threw away their idols. Ve'esgulule mitzrayim lo ozevu. And that they refused to desert the idols of Egypt. But Omar, and I said to myself, says God, Lishbot chamosi aleihem, I thought about pouring out my fury against them, Lachalos api bohem, to give them my full reign of my anger against them, Pesach Eretz Mitzrayim, in the middle of the land of Egypt, while they were still in the land of Egypt. So, what we see here, says the Radak, is that this expression, Eirom ve'Ariyeh, not only were you naked of mitzvahs, you didn't have anything to recommend you, but further than that, you were living like pagans. And as it happens, there are various midrashim to suggest that the Jews that came out of Egypt represented only 20% of the Jews that lived there, the Israelites that lived there. 80% of them were killed in the plague of darkness because they were blatant pagans. And that's why the Torah describes that the Jewish people left chamushim. Now, chamushim means armed. The literal translation that they left Egypt armed. Chamushim means with weapons. But chamushim also means a fifth. And there's various midrashim and Kabbalistic sources that say that 80% of the Israelites that lived in Egypt were just rampant pagans. And hence God says through Yechezkel later on, Lo hishlichu ve'es gelulei Mitzrayim lo azovu. They refused, they just wouldn't leave, they just wouldn't desert the Egyptian idolatry. They wouldn't desert it. And so it could be that when they left Egypt, although there was 2.3 million people, there could have been a lot more. So that's Aaron ve'Aries Ezer Adak. Not only were you naked of mitzvahs or good deeds or anything to recommend you, but you were the opposite as well. You were totally naked, fully on the other side of it. You were on the negative side. And here comes my favorite understanding of this, like this double expression. This comes from the Shlach, the Shlach HaKadosh, he's called the Shlach HaKadosh, Rabbi Yeshua Horovitz. He's called the Shlach because it was a sefer he wrote, the Shnei Luchos Habris. That's what Shlach stands for. Shnei Luchos Habris means the two tablets of the covenant. And this is a Musa book, but it's also Kabbalistic in nature as well. And he writes as follows. He says, since the havoc that was brought on God's creation originally at the beginning of time was due to the original Nachash, the snake, if you remember the story, and the snake being described in Bereishis, in the third chapter of Bereishis, the snake, v'hanochosh hoya orum mikol chayas asoda, asher oso Hashem Elohim. The snake was the most nakedly cunning of all the beasts of the field that God had created. And says the Shlach, we know that the sin of Adam and Chava came as a result of the orum, the naked seduction and deceptiveness of the snake. Part of the tikkun, part of the restitution, part of the repair for the sin that took place in the Garden of Eden that was brought about by the actions of the snake was that Israel had to descend into the Kor HaBarza, into the iron crucible of Egypt to experience what Yechezkel describes as being Aram the area, totally exposed, and to face the same nemesis. In other words, what do you do? What do they say? There's an interesting English expression that if you get drunk, you wake up with a hangover. What's the best thing to do, Harvey?
Hair of the dog.
The hair of the dog that bit you, right? Have another drink. You'll feel much better. And we know also from medicine that if you certain diseases, certain bacterial infections or certain viruses, we use the actual infection or the actual virus as a means of inoculating you. So in the same context, what often happens, well, certainly what happens here in the mind of the Shlach, which he gets from Kabbalistic sources, is that the sin that took place in the Garden of Eden with the snake, who was Arum, who was full of naked seduction and deceptiveness, that the repair for that sin, that whatever the sin was, we're not going to get into that now, but whatever the sin was in the Garden of Eden had to be repaired or partially repaired. And that's why the Jewish people went down to Egypt. The idea was that they would go into Egypt, Eron ve'Eriek, totally exposed, and to face the same nemesis, the same snake that Adam and Chava faced, but this time to defeat it. Remember, the snake punished by God was described as v'ofor tochal kol yemei chayecha, and you shall eat dust all the days of your life. That was the punishment that was given to the snake. And that, so that the Shlach says that the diet of the snake is ha'ofor, the dust. The dust represents the snake. And he says if you rearrange the letters of ha'ofor, the dust, you'll get the word paro. Pei, resh, ayin, hey. Hey, Ayin, Pei, Resh. Same letters make up the word Ha'afra, which is representative of the snake. What the snake, that the punishment of the snake. You rearrange those letters Ha'afra, you get the name Para. The Jews came down to Egypt, Eron ve'Eriyeh, totally exposed. Both Eron, the male, like Adam, and Eriyeh, female, just like Chava was. As the Torah describes them, after the snake seduced them to sin, because the Torah actually tells you that they, once the snake had seduced them to sin, it says, immediately, when they ate from the tree, whatever that means, the eyes of both of them were opened, vayedu ki eirumim, and they recognized that they were eirumim, they were naked. The Israelites came down to Egypt to take on for a second time, and this time to try and defeat the same dust-eating snake that had outsmarted Adam and Chava by being Orum, by being nakedly cunning, and it had brought death into the world by doing so. This time, the dust-eating snake that wanted to kill them, Heofar, was Paro, the dust-eater. And that is the reason why the first miracle performed in front of Paro was for Moshe Rabbeinu, was for Aaron actually to transform his stick, his staff, into a tannin, into a snake, which alludes to Pharaoh and the Israelites exactly who they were up against. As the Pasuk says, Vayavol Moshe ba'Aaron el Paro, Moshe and Aaron came to Paro. This is the first time they're meeting Paro. Vayasu kein kasher tzivo Hashem. And they did exactly what God told them to do. By Yashlech Aaron es Matehu, and Aaron threw down his stick, Lifnei Paro, in front of Paro. By Yehi Latanin, and it turned into a serpent, into a snake. So this is what the Shlosh says here. But at Eron ve'Eriyeh, that's got nothing to do with what was going on in the context of they were ready to be redeemed, they weren't ready to be redeemed. It's a commentary on the fact that the Jewish people were in Egypt as a direct result. It was the correction, the restitution, making amends for what happened in the Garden of Eden when they were outsmarted by Paro, outsmarted by the snake. And here in Egypt, the job was to outsmart the snake the second time and correct what happened in the Garden of Eden. Now, the Shlod doesn't say whether it was successful or unsuccessful, but that's what he says. That's what he says Eron ve'Eriyeh means, that you came down to Egypt like Adam and Chava, Eron ve'Eriyeh, completely naked, as if you'd just come out of the Garden of Eden. So that's that pasuk, and there's a lot more to say on that pasuk, but we have to move on because it's a long chapter. Just a footnote to this. As I said, there's about 20 explanations of what this means around Eriyeh. There's loads more in your Haggadahs if you on Seder night. But before we move on to the next verse, which I've termed "Time to Fall in Love," what's interesting about this verse, although it's a piece of poetry, really. I mean, it's a beautiful piece of poetry. If you read it, I let you thrive like a blossom in the field, and you grew and reached adulthood. You became perfectly beautiful with fashioned breasts, and your hair, your pubic hair grew, but you were still naked and bare. But surprisingly enough, despite the fact that that's just poetry, pose plus poetry, we learn halachas, we learn laws regarding what is appropriate intimacy from this verse. And the Shulchan Aruch, in the third section of the Shulchan Aruch, in Eben Ezer, in the 21st section, brings down halachas based on this pasuk. And it's actually very interesting. People are not really aware of these halachas, which they should be. And Shulchan Aruch writes as follows. He says, to hug or kiss one of the arroyos, one of your close relatives. We're talking about people who would be considered to be, if you had sexual relations with them, considered to be incest. So if you hug or kiss one of these people, your mother, your sister, or your father or your brother, close relatives who people don't normally lust after, Again, such as your sister, and he even brings the example of an aunt, even an aunt in American, even though he derives no pleasure at all, is reprehensible and forbidden, and the act of a fool. This is because there are no close relatives for the purpose of immorality at all, whether adult or minor, except the father. The only exceptions is a father to his daughter and the mother to her son. What's the halacha? Says the Shulchan Aruch, a father is permitted to hug his daughter and kiss her and sleep next to her. And so too a mother with her son, as long as the children are minors. When they grow up, so that the son is now an adult and the daughter also an adult, what is considered to be a man who has a daughter, when does he know that his daughter is an adult? He says, we know it from Yecheskel. Chapter 16, verse 7, Shadayim nochonu usareich tzimeach, when her breasts are formed and her pubic hair starts to grow. From that point on, both for men and for a mother wanting who sleeps in the same bed as a son, or a father who lies on the same bed as his daughter, that becomes forbidden at that point, and it's not allowed anymore. That's the cutoff point. Shadayim nachonu usarech tzimeach. For the man, it's usarech tzimeach when public pubic hair starts to grow. He can't share a bed with his mother anymore. I just don't think he'd want to share a bed with his mother, but it's according to the Shulchan Aruch, it's an issur d'oraisa, a biblical prohibition. But the thing that people don't really get, because it's more in the breach than in the acceptance, is kissing one of your relatives. It's completely awesome, you know, to kiss your close relatives. It's not appropriate, and halachically it's not considered to be appropriate behavior. Okay, I'm not going to harp on that, but let's move on to verse 8, and a continuing allegory. The time to fall in love, the story of the Israelites, or the founding baby girl, continues. And again, time to fall in love. God says, "Va'evar alayich." So they were naked and bare, and they developed breasts, and you know, they've got leaders, and they're approaching a point in time where it should have been the time for redemption. And God says, "Va'evar alayich, va'erech," and I passed by you, and I saw you. Vehine iteich es dodim. And behold, your time was the time of love. I mean, God said, I fell in love with you. Va'efros knofi alayich, and I spread my cloak over you. Va'achase erevoseich, and I covered up your nakedness. Va'eshov aloch, and I swore to you. Va'avor b'bris osoch, ne'um Hashem Elokim v'tehi li. And I came into an agreement with you, into a covenant with you, says God. Vatihi li, and you became mine, you were mine. So again, this is, you know, in beautiful poetry. I passed by you and saw you, and I fell in love with you, and I spread my garment over you, and I covered your nakedness, and I swore to you, and I proposed, so to speak, came into a covenant with you, says God, vati'ili, and you became mine, you were mine. So let's unpack this verse. This is a real verse here. Where do we start with this? God says, I passed by you and I saw you. What's interesting about this verse, verse 8, is that in verse 6, God has already mentioned this idea. If you look at verse 6 in the same chapter, two verses ago, God has already said, and I passed by you and saw you. That time was earlier, and then it was misboseses bedomayich. You were wallowing in your own birth blood. That was a lot earlier. The question is, why did God pass by the Israelites to take a second look at them? So the Sefer Chasidim, which again, ostensibly is a halachic book, but it also contains very deep Kabbalistic stuff. It was written by Rabbi Yehuda ben Shmuel HaChosid, Mi Regensburg. He lived in Regensburg in Germany in the 13th century. He died in 1200. And he explains this verse as follows. And there are, again, there are quite a few ways to understand this verse, or this introductory, these introductory words to this verse. Vo'evar alaych vo'erech, I passed by you and saw you for a second time. He says like this. He says, look, it says two verses ago, k'siv vo'evar alaych vo'erech. Odom shirotz lakachas isha. He says, when a person wants to find, realizes it's time to take a wife, tzorich lavor shom lirosa. He has to go and see her more than once. Begam hi tira oso. And she should also see him multiple times. She im lo yishra ba'enav lo yikachena. Because in order to determine if the match is appropriate, if the match is not appropriate, maybe both parties have got doubts, then obviously they shouldn't get married. So it's, you know, it's not a case of, you know, going on one date and or finding, you know, the woman you're going to marry or the man you're going to marry under the chuppah, says the Rabbi Yehuda ben Shmuel HaChosid, that's not the way to do it. This is what God's describing. You have multi, you go see her multiple times. Be'im yikochena b'lo ro'os, because if you don't do that, you could get to a situation where a couple get married, you know, having not spent enough time, not seen enough of each other. Shema yisna'eno, v'yikava v'yisava lemisosa, and you end up hating each other so much that they'll end up wishing for the death of their spouse. So God, he says, God is teaching a lesson here to men and women alike. Don't take a spouse before you're convinced they're the right ones for you. And he says, that's why God says here, both twice, on two different occasions, I passed by you to take a good look at you. And you could take a good look at me as well, because they saw the plagues that were coming in Egypt. God took a good look at them. They took a good look at him and to see if it's the right shidduch. And as the Gemara actually reinforces this idea, and this is something that also in some areas of the Orthodox Jewish world is not obeyed. It's not dealt with properly, and it causes problems, especially in today's society. And it's a Gemara in Kiddushin on Daf Mem Aleph Amad Aleph, and it's a famous Gemara, and more people should pay attention to it. It says, Omar Rabbi Yehuda Omar Rav. Rabbi Yehuda says in the name of Rav, Osa la Adam shi kadish is a isha ad shirena. It's forbidden for a man to marry a woman until he's seen her, and vice versa. And that's when he says seen her, Rashi says there, and all the Mephoshim say they're not just seen her once, and spend time together and get to know each other. Shema yira bo dobo maguna visizgana olov. Lest, you know, you've got to spend time with her because you might find something, you know, that's not right. You don't like about her. Like if you see her once, so, you know, or let's take it turn the other way around. She sees you once and she thinks you're a wonderful chap. But of course, you're on your best behavior first time round. Let's see how you behave second time round, third time round, fourth time round, fifth time round. You know, she might see something in you later on, or he might see something in her later on that makes them an inappropriate match. And he says if that happens, the marriage is going to end up in tragedy, and they'll become repugnant to each other. The Gemara says, Shema yireh bo maguna v'sizgan olo, and they'll end up hating each other. Now, there's a famous story that is told about Rabbi Yitzchok Elchanan Spector. So Rabbi Yitzchok Elchanan Spector was a great Iloi. He was a great genius. And by the time he was 14, so everyone knew he was going to be, you know, a superstar. He lived in the end of the middle of the 19th century. He was in yeshiva in Novorodok, somewhere out in Ukraine, somewhere, I don't know where it is, Lithuania, Ukraine area. And so, you know, they got married very early in those days. So all the wealthy from father-in-laws in the area, so they wanted their daughter to marry this young kid. He was 14 years old, Rabbi Yitzchok Elchanan Spector. Anyone that has ever been to Yeshiva University should know the name Rabbi Yitzchok Elchanan Spector. because Yeshiva University is named after him. Reitz, it's called. Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Talmudical Seminary. It's named after Rabbi Yitzchok Elchanan Spector. So there's a famous story about him. So this very, very wealthy man, he had a beautiful daughter, and he wanted this Rabbi Yitzchok Elchanan to be his son-in-law. So he said to his daughter came home from school one day. Remember, they used to get married at 14, 15, and she came home from school, and they all said, you know, Mazel tov, Mazel tov. She says, what's the Mazel tov? They said, you're engaged. She says, who am I engaged to? She says, you're engaged to Rabbi Yitzchok Elchanan Spector. She says, listen to me. He says, I'm not marrying anybody until I've had a good look at him. So forget it. Let me see him first. So Rabbi Yitzchok Elchanan Spector used to come home for lunch from the yeshiva, from Navaradok. Used to come home for his lunch. And he used to sit at the table having his lunch. And while he was having his lunch, he'd carry on learning. So they said, okay, so we'll take you, I said to this girl, we'll take you around to see him. And you can have a look at a, you can see him through a peephole in the kitchen, through the kitchen door, and you can have a look and see what you think of him. So she comes from a very wealthy family, you know, proper, born with a silver spoon in her mouth, and he's from a very poor family. And so she comes around to his, they bring her around to his house, and he's come from, home from the yeshiva for his lunch, and he's sitting in the kitchen. Picture this: he's sitting in the kitchen, holding a Gemara. And he's got a hand in a bowl of spaghetti and tomato sauce. And he's got, filling his mouth with the spaghetti with his hands as he's holding the Gemara with his other hand. He's looking up at the Gemara. And as he's looking at the reading of the Gemara, he's, you know, but with his fingers putting, spaghetti and tomato sauce in his mouth. So you can imagine his mouth, his whole face was covered in tomato ketchup. And she took one look at him and she said, you know, this is, I'm not marrying this guy. He's a barbarian. I'm not marrying this guy. He's a kid with he can't even, doesn't even know how to eat properly. She says, I'm not a nursemaid. I'm not going to educate him how to eat properly. Forget about it. So the shidduch was off. So 40 years later, as luck would have it, or maybe it wasn't luck, 40 years later, after Rabbi Yitzchok Elchanan got married and his wife died, and this young girl, she also got married and her husband died. So she came to Rabbi Yitzchok, and by that time, he was the Gadol Hador. He was the greatest man of the generation. The Posek Hador, he's very famous for having, he was the one that gave the heter, gave the permission for the Heter Mechira, to sell the produce of the land of Israel during the Shemitah year to non-Jews. That's the Heter Mechira we have. That comes from him, Rabbi Yitzchok Elchanan Spector. So 40 years have passed, and she goes, and she's a widow, and he's a widower, and she goes round to his house, and she knocks on the door, and he opens the door, and she says to him, you know, I don't know if you remember me, Rabbi, but 40 years ago, they wanted to make a shidduch between you and me, and Letzari, I made a mistake, and you know, I didn't take up the offer. She says, but now, you know, you're a widower and I'm a widow. You know, how about it? So he says to her, and he writes this in his tumors. He says, so listen, if I wasn't good enough for you then, you know, I'm probably not good enough for you now. And that was the end of the shidduch second time around. But the point of the Gemara is very clear here. And the message that Yecheskel's trying to put over here as well is God was good. They were in Egypt a long time. God took a good look at them regularly. He just didn't take just one look. And that's the way you should sort out your marriage as well. You should be absolutely sure. So God, so to speak, in order to teach us a rule of thumb regarding rushing into marriages and shidduchim, et cetera, which is a huge problem in the religious world today, takes another look at the Israelites. As he says here, I took another good look at you to make sure that you're the right nation to invest in. And what does God discover? God discovers, as the verse continues, beautiful verse continues, V'hinei iteich eis dodim. Behold, your time was a time of love. So God said, I fell in love with you. After taking a second look at the Jews, the Israelites, God decided the Israelites were the right nation for him. These are my boys. This is my girl. And I'm going to marry him. And now is the time to redeem them and marry them and fulfill my promise to Abraham. After all, the Israelites were observing one mitzvah only, which we discussed last week, which was the mitzvah of Bris Milah. That was the one thing that they did in Egypt, the one thing they'd always done. And this was God's promise to Abraham in Bereshit, chapter 15, verse 14. The nation that they will serve, I will judge, the Egyptians, and afterwards they will leave with great possessions. That was God's promise. And God says, right, okay, that was at the Bris, the covenant, the Jewish people were keeping the Bris. It's the one thing they did do. So God says, right, okay. So after deciding to redeem the Israelites, save the foundling baby, what did God do? God says, again, the continuation of the allegory, the continuation of the verse, Va'efros k'nafay alayeh, God says, and I spread my cloak over you. Rashi says, what does it mean? God spread his cloak over their nakedness. Says Rashi, that God revealed himself to Moshe Rabbeinu at the burning bush and instructed him, together with Aaron, to act as my protector of you during the final period of your slavery in Egypt by facing up to Pharaoh. And then he says, I covered up your nakedness. What does that mean, that God covered up their nakedness? And Barbanel clues us in here. He says, because you were totally exposed, totally helpless, totally defenseless in Egypt, I covered your nakedness, meaning the parable of covering up your nakedness and giving you protection is that God began to send signs and wonders, the plagues, against the land of Egypt to show the Israelites, that although the Egyptians were making fun of the Jews, I thought that they didn't have any God. They were talking about their God, but he hadn't shown himself for 200 years. So they were making fun of them. So God said, right, but although the Egyptians thought there was no God of Israel that was sympathetic and compassionate to the Israelites, and the Egyptians were convinced that the Jews were naked and defenseless. Now, says Rol ki yad Hashem nikra lehem. Now, when the plagues arrived, says the Abarbanel, they saw the hand of God that was protecting the Israelites. That's what it means. Va'achasa ervoseich, I covered your nakedness. And then, finally, or not finally in the verse, but the last statement, the penultimate statement in the verse, God says, I swore to you, I made you an oath. God made an oath to the Israelites to redeem them. And we see this in the Torah. Yechezkel is just repeating here what we know from the Torah to be true. This is in Shemos chapter 6, verses 6 to 7. Lochain, therefore, says God, Emo livnei Yisrael ani Hashem. God tells Moshe to tell the Bnei Yisrael, the Jews, the Israelites, Emo livnei Yisrael, tell the children of Israel, Ani Hashem, I am God, and I'm going to take you out from under the slavery, the burden of Egypt. And I will save you from servitude. And I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgments or miracles. And then I'm going to take you for me as a people. I'm going to marry you. And I will be to you a husband, a God. And you will know that I am God. who is the one who brought you out of servitude of Egypt. And then God says, finally, and created a covenant with you, says God, meaning I gave you the Torah. I took you out of Egypt, which we're going to discuss next week, and not next week, in a few weeks' time. And I gave you the Torah. That is the bris. That is the chuppah, we're going to describe in the next verses. Now, when they leave Egypt, they go, it's like the engagement period, the period of Nisuin. They're going to be taken to the chuppah at Mount Sinai. And what was the catalyst for this next stage? The final words of this verse. The final words of this verse are "Vatiyili," very, very interesting words. And you became mine. At that point, so to speak, God put the engagement ring on the finger of the Jewish people, the Israelites in Egypt. He was performing the miracles, preparing to take them out, preparing to take them to the chuppah. "Vatiyili," at that point, you became mine, meaning my giving and your accepting of my marriage proposal and the coming chuppah, the marriage vows, which would take place on Mount Sinai, means vatiyili, you will become mine, or you became mine. And that's exactly what God said. These are exactly the words that God said on Mount Sinai. Va'atem tiyuli mamlechas kohanim v'go kodash, and you will be to me a kingdom of kohanim, a kingdom of priests, and a holy nation. And so this is the point where the Jews are leaving Egypt. God has covered them up. He's protecting them now. There are plagues striking Egypt. They're ready to escape. They're ready to be taken out. They're mature to the extent that they've got leaders that can show them the way. As we said last week, everybody, even though they weren't doing it the whole time, but by the time it comes to the point of the Exodus, every male was circumcised and every male got themselves involved in the Korban Pesach. And at that point, God says, right, I've taken a look at you a few times. You're the ones for me. And God says, right, time to leave Egypt. So what did God do next? So the chuppah is being prepared on Mount Sinai. And this is where we'll start off next time. Verse 9, I'll just read it to you. And I washed you with water. And I rinsed all the blood from upon you. And I anointed you with oil. So we'll see exactly what that means, what that relates to in the context of the Exodus and in the context of the receiving of the Torah, which is essentially the marriage ceremony, which, again, just going back to the allegory, of the foundling child has reached maturity, and the gentleman that found her and looked after her and brought her up and gave her everything is now marrying her. So that's the allegory here. So that's where we're up to. They're leaving Egypt. They're being washed and prepared for their chuppah, for their marriage, and that's where we'll leave it at verse 9. But I just want to mention, which I think I should. Is there'll be no shiur for the next 2 weeks. There'll be no shiur next Monday, which is the 26th, and there'll be no shiur on the 4th. The next shiur will be, Larry will send out a reminder, but the next shiur will be on the 11th, 11th of March. Please God, I'll be back by then. Until then, unless there's any questions, I wish you all a great week, and I'll see you all when I get back from the Antipodeans. Is it the Antipodeans? I'm not sure. Where the in Springbok Land. Springbok Land. That's where I go. So I hope you enjoyed the shiur. Look forward to seeing you again. 3 weeks today, same time, same place. Everyone have a great week. Kol tov to everybody.
Thanks, Harry.
Thanks, Harry.
See you later, Harry.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.